WBAI-FM.org and WBAI-FM. Good afternoon, everybody. This is Zainal Amin with the Shai Nana Show. Today I'll be sharing a segment, a really important segment, about the Zohran win that was provided by Electronic Intifada. We'll break down what it means, especially because there are some people, allies really, that are seeing this as Groundhog Day, meaning some people who are pro-Palestinians are rightly suspicious, but this information provided today will set their minds at ease, because I mean, it's not going to be an easy job to fulfill these promises when the federal government is against you and every billionaire in the country is up in arms. The main thing that's happening is people are saying, are we going to see what we saw with the Bernie Sanders campaign and the AOC campaigns, where they basically, with Bernie Sanders not only caving in to the Democratic Party and relinquishing his position as the most popular politician to let somebody else run in the Democratic Party, that is an unpopular dinosaur. The doubts are well founded, because we've been betrayed. And in the case of Bernie, also in the case of this genocide, you know, first of all, I'm happy that that Bernie Sanders is resuscitated by the Zohran win, because it proves that if the Democratic Party, with Obama at the lead, didn't organize an et tu brute assassination of Bernie Sanders back in 2016, we wouldn't have had Biden, we wouldn't have had Trump, we wouldn't have had a genocide, certainly a genocide that's being built on by Trump right now. These people have been burned, and they're rightly suspicious of the fact that we've seen the Democratic Party again and again bury social movements. That's one thing. The other thing I wanted to mention before we go into our clip is another big story is the first of all, the bombing of Gaza and Lebanon is continuing, with Israel breaking the ceasefire thousands of times in Lebanon and breaking the ceasefire in Gaza on daily basis, so far killing over 250 Palestinians after the ceasefire was declared. So this is their MO. They basically agree to a ceasefire, and then they start bombing and destroying infrastructure and killing civilians, and saying it's in the name of diminishing the resistance, even though they had the resistance on both ends of the border have agreed to the terms, or have abided by the terms of the ceasefire. Another story that's happening is that that I wanted to mention is the Anti-Defamation League is one of the many Zionist entities that is having a fit, because Mamdani has won, and they have set up a Mamdani monitor, which in turn people reminded them that there is a monitor set on them, because the Anti-Defamation League, which pretends to be a civil rights organization, has been involved with what Jewish Voice for Peace has called the deadly exchange, that is training the NYPD, or here in DC, the MPD, the police forces, and in Chicago, the police forces there, in training them how to suppress their population, specifically populations of color. And that's why Zohran had mentioned years ago that, that the NYPD boot, jackboot that's on the neck of citizens is laced by the IDF. And it's a correct story. And so the ADL came out and to state that they were never involved in this kind of deadly exchange. They never facilitated this kind of thing. And within the same thing, within the same 5 minutes, they say that we are involved in that. And you have to remember that this is the like exhibit A in terms of what we've seen, in terms of how when you let things like a genocide happen overseas, and when you arm, you contribute to the military-industrial complex, the industrial military-industrial complex dumps its overstock and onto the local military forces, and these local military forces are go and train in Israel, where the IDF teaches them how to use these weapons that they've experimented on with Palestinians, on Palestinians, and they come back, and we're seeing the result now with these militarized entities that are attacking our urban centers with the cooperation of the police forces. So that's another important story. And lastly, before we go into our clip, I wanted to just mention one thing that's been on the minds of many people, and that is the Democratic Party cave-in, of course, on the government shutdown, that where now people are finally calling for Schumer and Jeffries and others to step down for this cowardly act that Schumer orchestrated and pretended he's not part of it by that he wasn't part of this whole scheme. So that's of course the story that's we're going to follow in the upcoming week. So with that, I wanted to share with you this clip of Electronic Intifada, where Ali Abu Nima is talking about why the Zohran win is driving the both parties and Israel, the Zionists in the United States, mad. So let's have a listen.
You're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream, and I'm Ali Abu Nima. And of course, as we know, that on November 4th, Zohran Mamdani won the mayoral election in New York City with just over 50% of the vote. He was the first mayoral candidate to win more than 1 million votes since 1969. And this election also had the highest turnout since that year. Zohran Mamdani moved to the U.S. at the age of 7. He attended public school in New York and became a U.S. citizen in 2018. His father is Mahmoud Mamdani, the Columbia University professor, well known for his book, Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, which came out in the context of the so-called war on terror in the years after 9/11. And his mother is the noted film director, Mira Nair. Now, since 2021, Zohran Mamdani has represented New York City's Astoria neighborhood in the New York State Assembly, and that was his first elected office. He ran a campaign for mayor that focused on reforms aimed at improving the lives of New Yorkers and making the city more affordable, particularly free, fast public buses and controlling rent. His opponents ran a national and even international smear campaign against him, inciting bigotry because of his Muslim and South Asian Ugandan background, and particularly because of his longtime support for Palestinian rights, which, of course, is why this is a topic for us. First, some disclosure, I suppose. I actually first got to know Zohran Mamdani in 2013 when he was a student at Bowdoin College in Maine. He was in his third year there, and he was the co-chair of the SJP group, the Students for Justice in Palestine group, and he invited me to go and give a talk at Bowdoin College, which I did in 2013. You can actually see there, Zohran K. Mamdani, mayor-elect of New York City, saying Bowdoin SJP is so excited to be hosting Ali Abunehmeh to the Shannon Room at 7:30 Monday, 28th of October. That was back in 2013. And my talk there, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. I spent, you know, a day with Zohran Mamdani and his colleagues there. And frankly, he impressed me as very smart, very engaged, and very sincere in his support for Palestinian rights, which he also has expressed for many years. He was also an avid reader of the Electronic Intifada. Here you can see him back in 2014 sharing an article by Max Blumenthal, published by the Electronic Intifada. So I am not a close personal friend of Zohran Mamdani by any means, but since I met him in 2013, we've stayed in touch with each other from a distance, on and off. And my exposure to him gives me the sense that he's very sincere in his basic conditions, these basic positions, that these were not positions that he suddenly adopted in order to win support from a left-wing or grassroots base. So how would we sum up his views? In general, he is describes himself as a democratic socialist, which means in practice he is a mild reformist. He has been a strong supporter of Palestinian rights. And I think this moment early in the Democratic Party primary for the mayor of New York caught a lot of people's attention when he distinguished himself from the rest of the field by not automatically prostrating himself to Israel. Let's take a look at this video and remind ourselves.
Visit by a mayor of New York is always considered significant. Where would you go first? That's right, Ms. Adams.
First visit, I would visit the Holy Land.
Mr. Cuomo?
Given the hostility and the anti-Semitism that has been shown in New York, I would go to Israel.
Mr. Tilson, where would you go?
Yeah, I'd make my fourth trip to Israel, followed by my fifth trip to Ukraine, two of our greatest allies fighting on the front lines of the global war on terror.
Mr. Mamdani?
I would stay in New York City. My plans are to address New Yorkers across the five boroughs and focus on that.
Mr. Mamdani, can I just jump in? Would you visit Israel mayor?
I will be doing, as the mayor, I'll be standing up for Jewish New Yorkers, and I'll be meeting them wherever they are across the five boroughs, whether that's in their synagogues and temples or at their homes or at the subway platform, because ultimately we need to focus on delivering on their concerns.
And just yes or no, do you believe in a Jewish state of Israel?
I believe Israel has the right to exist.
Not as a Jewish state?
As a state with equal rights.
He won't say it has a right to exist as a Jewish state.
And his answer was no, he won't visit Israel.
I said that.
That's what he was trying to say.
Unlike you, I answered very directly.
My goal would be to take my first trip to Israel. My wife's life work in this area means a lot to our family.
So, although he did say he believes in Israel's right to exist, language I would not use myself, he did say inequality, which of course is something that all the people on stage there object to, because they don't believe in equality when it comes to Israel. They believe Israel has the right to be a racist Jewish supremacist state, an apartheid state, and Mamdani at least held the line on that. He made some other pledges during the campaign that were very notable. For example, we can see the headline here, Mamdani, if elected mayor, pledges to order NYPD, that's the New York Police Department, to arrest Netanyahu. So he stuck to that position during the campaign. He also did not back down from calling Israel's mass slaughter in Gaza a genocide. However, he did make gestures towards supporters of Israel during the campaign, as we can see from this clip of him speaking on The View on October 1st. Let's look at that.
Running for mayor of New York and not prime minister of Israel, but you've made inflammatory statements like calling Israel an apartheid state and questioning its right to exist as a Jewish state. Just this week, you were evasive with a reporter about condemning Hamas. Given New York has the largest Jewish population outside of Israel, why should voters who see this as a moral red line trust your clarity and judgment?
Well, I really appreciate this question and an opportunity to just clear up, I think, a number of misconceptions. You know, first and foremost, you're right. I am running to be the mayor of the city, and this city will be the focus of my administration, ensuring that we make this a city everyone can afford and everyone knows that they belong to. And also, millions of New Yorkers, myself included, care deeply about what's happening in Israel and Palestine. And so to be very, very clear, of course I condemn Hamas. Of course I've called October 7th what it was, which is a horrific war crime. And of course, my belief in a universality in international law is also the same set of beliefs that have led me to describe what's happening in Gaza as a genocide. Because what we see...
So, as you can see there, he stood by the term genocide, but some of the positions you heard there and others during the campaign did dismay many of his supporters, who worried that these were early signs that he might back down in the face of pro-Israel pressure, you know, playing the condemnation game and condemning October 7th in the terms that Israel supporters describe it, rather than saying this was a resistance operation. Yes, any deliberate harm to civilians we would condemn, but nonetheless, there's a right to resist. You know, that might be something, a position closer to what I might say or what someone else might say, but it's definitely not what Zohran Mamdani said. And so, you know, this generates criticism. There are a lot of people on the left who are critical and skeptical of anyone who remains within the Democratic Party. And, you know, the saying goes, you don't change the party changes you. And they point to his close association with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who people see as having really betrayed many progressive positions that she ran on and built a base of support for, including on Palestine, and also his close association with Bernie Sanders, who I think has disillusioned many people by his absolute refusal at first to even call for a ceasefire, and then his refusal until it was really much too late to even call it a genocide. So those are things that have attracted criticism. Also, recently, he again sort of in response to some of this kind of constant pushing on these issues, he referred to the leaders of Venezuela and Cuba as dictators at the very moment that the Trump administration is ramping up for war there. He could have said nothing, but he chose to use that language, and that has certainly generated criticism of him from the left. But there's no doubt that Mamdani is well informed about the pro-Israel complicity of the city he is about to lead. And here he is speaking specifically about the New York Police Department, and this was, according to the label on the video, in 2023.
We have to make clear that when the boot of the NYPD is on your neck, it's been laced by the IDF.
So what he said there, just to repeat, we have to make clear that when the boot of the NYPD is on your neck, it's been laced by the IDF. And what he's referring to there is the fact that the NYPD has close ties to the Israeli military and police, including many exchange programs. And the NYPD even has a liaison office in Israel. And here's a story from the New York Post just a few days ago, quoting the outgoing head of that liaison office, Detective Charlie Ben Naim. And quote, it says, Ben Naim has been in charge of gathering intelligence, investigating events, and sharing information with the NYPD to keep the city safe since 2007, he told the Post last year. When the October 7, 2023 Hamas attacks happened, he was working with local authorities in Israel and sharing information with the NYPD, he said. Quote, whenever there's a terror attack in Israel, I respond to the scene. Ben Naim said after the terror attacks by Hamas in southern Israel, he then sends his assessment back to the department. The priority is to identify these trends and stop them before they have the potential to come to our city, he said. Now, this is particularly disturbing since the NYPD ran a massive secret spying and surveillance program against Arabs and Muslims, even beyond the borders of NYC, in New Jersey, a state where it has no jurisdiction, after 9/11, as the Associated Press revealed in a series of investigative reports for which its team of reporters won a number of Pulitzer Prizes. This was back around 2011-2012, detailing this massive surveillance of mosques, of businesses, of just people who look, based on racial profiling. New York police official even confirmed to the Associated Press that the NYPD spying program was modeled on how Israeli authorities spy on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. So that's the NYPD. And a big concession that Mamdani has already made is agreeing to keep Jennifer Tisch on as the NYPD police commissioner. Tisch comes from an extremely wealthy, powerful pro-Israel family. And of course, the NYPD played a key role in crushing the Palestine Solidarity encampment at Columbia University and other colleges in New York City over the last 2 years. So the NYPD is an extremely powerful and largely unaccountable force. And basically, even though the mayor is sort of nominally in charge, it is a power unto itself. It is, as often noted, larger than the militaries of many countries and has a larger budget than the militaries of many countries. So I suppose some people would argue that this is a pragmatic choice because the NYPD can ruin a mayor's tenure if they choose to, because they are basically unaccountable. But that is the reality. So what could Mamdani do as mayor? I think it's important to remember that he's the mayor of New York City, or he's going to be as of January 1st. So it's unrealistic to expect too much. There are things he could do, for example, perhaps end New York Police Department involvement with Israel. He could end New York City's purchasing of Israel bonds. In fact, the current city controller did not renew a $39 million investment in Israel bonds when they matured in 2023. And Mamdani has said he will maintain that policy. In other words, he says New York City will not purchase Israel bonds anymore. And there is a battle shaping up over hundreds of millions of dollars of city pension funds, which are invested in Israel. That's another area where the mayor could conceivably act. And he could end city involvement or concessions towards Israeli institutions in New York, like Technion, the Israeli university that's deeply involved in weapons development and oppression of Palestinians. In fact, Mamdani has said he will look at Cornell University's partnership with Technion, which uses city-owned land in New York City when he becomes mayor. All that said, whatever Mamdani may or may not do, whether he holds the line or makes more concessions, you know, what's the meaning of his victory? Aside from the direct implications of for New York City, aside from what we think about Mamdani as a person or his intentions, and I think there's a few conclusions to draw from here. It is a massive repudiation by voters of the pro-Israel establishment. Billionaires, Donald Trump, the Israeli government and its lobby all lined up against him with an unprecedented smear and hate campaign. It failed. He won more than 50% of the votes on a record turnout. That sends a broader message nationally and internationally. I think it exposes the battle within the Democratic Party over Israel. We've talked about, in previous weeks, we've talked about how support for Israel in the base of the Democratic Party, in other words, the voters, is in single digits. But this is not reflected in the leadership, the sort of aging establishment in the Democratic Party that refuses to let go of power and refused to endorse Mamdani for the most part, but he still won. And this does reflect the profound shifts in public opinion we've been talking about and the loss of support for Israel across the board. And I think significantly, it reflects the failure of tried and tested strategies of racist fear-mongering and hatred, especially targeting Muslims, that have been really both Democratic and Republican plays for decades, particularly since after 9/11. So what's likely to come next? I think an important lesson here, and one I really hope that Zohran Mamdani will take on board, is that his more conciliatory tone and comments during the election, some of the things we heard just in the last few minutes, they did absolutely nothing to appease his critics, which is not surprising since all of their attacks are in bad faith. These are white supremacists, these are Islamophobes, these are Israel firsters. Nothing you can say will appease them. There will never come a moment, no matter how much Zohran Mamdani gives them, where they say, okay, you're a good boy now, we'll support you. That day will never come. Here, for example, is an editorial in the Washington Post just the day before the election. The headline there, Zohran Mamdani's success is a warning. And there's this one line in this staff editorial from the Washington Post that says, quote, Mamdani has walked back some of his old positions, but never very convincingly. While he apologized to the NYPD and said he would retain the current mayor's police commissioner, he recently admitted he hadn't spoken to her since making the offer. So that concession wasn't enough for the Washington Post. And then they say, and while he no longer defends eliminationist rhetoric about Jews, he remains fixated with Israel. I mean, there's so much dishonesty in this. First of all, he has never used eliminationist rhetoric about Jews or defended it. And he has not been fixated on Israel in this campaign. It is his opponents who have been fixated on Israel and who insisted on making this campaign a referendum on Israel. And the absolute lie about him engaging in or defending eliminationist rhetoric about Jews is exposed by none other than the Times of Israel. Take a look at this article in the Times of Israel, which was published after he won. The headline there, facing an anti-Zionist mayor, Mamdani's election win puts New York Jews in uncharted waters. Now, this is a story designed to feed the scaremongering. But even here, the Times of Israel has to admit, quote, his condemnations are solely aimed at Israel and Zionism, not at Jews or Judaism. That's the Times of Israel. Perhaps the Washington Post editorial writers should read the Times of Israel. I think it's also notable, according to CNN's exit poll, that Mamdani garnered 33% of Jewish votes in New York City, while his main opponent, Andrew Cuomo, who is backed by the Democratic Party establishment and by Donald Trump, got 63% of the Jewish vote. I think the fact that one-third of Jewish voters opted for Mamdani is significant, given the enormous smear campaign aimed at painting him as a mortal danger to Jews. And there were all these scare stories that if Mamdani wins, Jews are going to flee New York and this kind of thing. I think all obvious nonsense. This caught my eye, this tweet from the academic Shibli Telhami. He says, and I think this is really some astute observations. He says, deep down, Israeli leaders likely know that Mamdani won not despite his support for Palestinian rights, but partly because of it. And Shibli Telhami points to this tweet from Israeli official or former official Gilad Erdan. He is a former senior minister in the Netanyahu government, is also the until recently the U.S. The Israeli ambassador to the U.S. and then before that the United Nations. And what Gilad Erdan wrote, and this is very, I'll say why I think this is so important. He says, the mayor of New York is Zohran Mamdani. It's crucial to internalize this. An Israel hater who sees us as an apartheid state, who perpetrates genocide and does not recognize Israel as a Jewish state, was elected tonight to lead the most important city in the world, home to the largest number of Jews outside Israel. This is a dark day, a sad day for everyone who understands the immense importance of the alliance with the United States and is anxious about its future. Because what happened in New York could happen next across the entire United States, including in Congress and the White House. This is a huge warning sign. And Israel must wake up and implement a comprehensive plan to rebrand ourselves in the United States, a plan that will foster broad and deep connections with the younger generation and minority communities in the United States. So there's a lot packed into this tweet by Gilad Erdan. Why do I think it's significant coming from him? Because one of his positions about a decade ago, Gilad Erdan, was Minister for Strategic Affairs in Israel. And his job was to fight the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, particularly in the United States. And his job was to do precisely what he claimed Israel needs to do now, which was to rebrand it and to build support among minority, what he says, broad and deep connections with the younger generation and minority communities in the U.S. And he miserably failed at that, because the understanding that Israeli leaders still have is they look at it and they say, there's nothing wrong with what we're doing. It's just that we're bad at public relations, we're bad at marketing, and if we hire a better PR firm, then no one will have a problem with Israel. They can't internalize the reality that people are revolted and revulsed by what Israel does, and no more so than in the past 2 years with this genocide. But one of the things that Gilad Erdan used to point out when he was Minister of Strategic Affairs more than a decade ago, is that we have to stop the rot now, particularly on college campuses, because the students now who are in Students for Justice in Palestine or exposed to Palestine activism on campus, they are going to be the mayors, the members of Congress, the secretaries of state, the leaders of media organizations in the future, maybe even the president. And so Zohran Mamdani's rise, again, this is regardless of what you personally think about, you know, he said this or he said that or what he's going to do. His rise is their worst nightmare, because he was literally the co-chair of Students for Justice in Palestine on his college campus when they invited me to go and speak all those years ago. At the time, I believe that Gilad Erdan was in charge of trying to stop this. So I think it's significant in that sense. And then finally, you know, just what's going to happen next? It's very clear that Israel and its lobby will continue to join the right-wing smear campaign to destroy Mamdani, to ensure that he is a failure as mayor on all his promises, and to try to do to him what they successfully did to Jeremy Corbyn in the UK. Already two major Israel lobby groups have announced efforts to monitor Mamdani, and we can expect an endless stream of smears and fake anti-Semitism scandals. For example, the American Jewish Committee, one of the major pro-Israel lobby groups, their director in New York wrote, we may not be able to change your mind on these issues. He's referring to Israel. He wrote this open letter to Mamdani. He says, we may not be able to change your mind on these issues, referring to Israel. However, we will be vigilant in ensuring that New York City government and your position as mayor are not used to hold Israel to a double standard or to attempt to isolate Israel economically in an effort to dismantle the world's only Jewish state. So here we have the American Jewish Committee pledging to be a watchdog and a guardian for a foreign state, for the interests of a foreign country. And similarly, the Anti-Defamation League, another major Israel lobby group, they very proudly announced that they that the ADL launches initiative to track and monitor Mamdani administration policies and appointments. And it says here, quote, Mayor-elect Mamdani has promoted anti-Semitic narratives associated with individuals who have a history of anti-Semitism and demonstrated intense animosity toward the Jewish state that is counter to the views of the overwhelming majority of Jewish New Yorkers. We're deeply concerned that those individuals and principles will influence his administration at a time when we are tracking a brazen surge of harassment, vandalism, and violence targeting Jewish residents and institutions in recent years, said Jonathan Greenblatt, ADL CEO and national director. So you can see that none of Mamdani's copious rhetoric condemning anti-Semitism, pledging to fight anti-Semitism, which I believe he is entirely sincere about. I've never seen any evidence that Mamdani is a racist in any way. On the contrary, he is deeply opposed to all forms of bigotry. But none of his assertions about that have done anything to appease these Israel lobby groups, because they don't care about anti-Jewish bigotry. They only care about maintaining Israel as a genocidal apartheid state. And as long as Mamdani doesn't support Israel and Israeli apartheid, they will continue to accuse him of being an anti-Semite. So again, the message there is do not appease them. It won't work. It will only weaken you. So I think I'll leave it there, and we can bring everyone in for some discussion.
Thanks for that, Ali. Yeah, it's the Corbyn model needs to be disrupted whenever it pops up. And Asa, I know you can talk about that. A couple of years ago, before the genocide, I spoke with Mamdani for an article that I was writing for EI about when he was an assembly member. I believe his office actually contacted us because he was spearheading this bill to stop New York City or New York State based charities from funding settlement colonies in the West Bank. Mamdani introduced the bill. He stood with, you know, various local Palestine solidarity groups in New York City to support it. And I mean, I remember my conversation was with him was, you know, he was very appreciative of the coverage and, you know, very charismatic. And he said, you know, funding colonialism and violence is not a charitable activity, and I look forward to working with my colleagues in our fight to make that explicit in New York state law. He had a lot to say about settler violence and the U.S. support of colonialism in Palestine. I am, like all of us, cautious, because whenever someone, you know, is elevated to that level in politics, especially, you know, given a blessing by, of course, Barack Obama in recent weeks, and, you know, of course, by AOC and Bernie Sanders, as you mentioned, you know, we have to kind of double down on our caution. But I guess it remains to be seen whether his values that he says he grew up with, and especially as a member of SJP and someone who's been working, you know, to make New York City a less racist place. I don't know. I mean, we can be optimistic, maybe.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the bigger question is, like, how much power does the mayor of New York really have? I'm not suggesting this is not an important and powerful position. It certainly is.
Yeah.
But, you know, even on the key pledges he made that he focused on, which is affordability and housing, it's going to be really difficult for him, if not impossible, to fulfill those pledges because, you know, the property barons of New York will not want that. They will not want limits on luxury development. They will not want controls on rent. They will not want initiatives that support really affordable housing or social housing for people. So he's going to face tremendous opposition, and probably not primarily because of his views on Palestine. So he's going to be under tremendous pressure to surrender on really those key promises, and if he doesn't give in, they will do everything to break him. So it's really a huge challenge that he's facing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is, you know, the MO of the Democratic Party to, you know, to platform real progressives, people who start off, you know, as real leftists, and even call themselves socialists, and then wear them down into, you know, faint shadows of what they were, in order to toe the Democratic Party line. And, you know, we've seen those tactics over and over again. You know, I don't have a lot of faith, in it this time. But my ears are remain open.
And the view you're giving, Nora, is one that a lot of people share. You know, they are deeply skeptical, if not outright hostile, to the Democratic Party because of what it's done,
for all the reasons
it stands for, for very good reasons. Yeah. I mean, the fact that that Kamala Harris and Joe Biden were in charge of this genocide for you know, the first year, and you know, this may not matter in the end, because ultimately, you know, how much power does an individual have? It may not matter in the end, but to be fair to Zohran Mamdani, I think he's different from some of the other figures you've talked about on a personal level, whether it's Bernie Sanders or Barack Obama, who is seen as the great betrayer, and AOC. Mm-hmm. In that Zohran Mamdani has a very long and very explicit and very detailed commitment to supporting Palestinian rights that none of them had. I mean, Bernie Sanders, yes, he's been critical on Israel for many years, but within very strict liberal Zionist limits. And we saw during the first, you know, until very recently, he wouldn't call this a genocide. He wouldn't call for a ceasefire. AOC had gained attention and support for making statements about Palestine when she was running, but then as soon as she was pressured, she said, "Oh, I don't really know enough about it. I need to learn more." It will be so. There's two aspects to this. One, I think Mamdani's commitment is deeper and longer. And because he has a long record of stating these positions, it's much harder for him to turn on them. And that is a new element here. And what that does in terms of shaping discussion within the Democrat, within and beyond the Democratic Party, will be interesting to see. Will this embolden more candidates to say some of the things which they may think already, given the shift in opinion in this country, but don't dare to say? In other words, while not having, again, this is the mayor of New York. It's not the president of the United States. It's not, understanding the limits, I think we have to be at least open to unexpected consequences from this, unintended consequences, even if Mamdani disappoints people on A, B, C, and D.
Which he will, because he's a politician.
Politicians are politicians. No matter how much you like them personally, they're still politicians. You have to remember that.
Yeah.
But still, this is both the this is the consequence of the opening of space that has accelerated because of the genocide in Gaza. And at the same time, it will have consequences of their own. And we just need to be attentive to that and not just think we know in advance, this it doesn't mean anything because of this, this, and this, or it means everything. We don't know. Things are changing. People are skeptical because they say things are the same because they've always been the same. But then eventually they change. Is this that moment? I don't know. Probably not. Could be, might be the start of it. I'm saying keep an open mind.
Politicians are politicians, and they have to be held to account. That's the beginning and the end of it, really. No matter, even if we like him more, he still has to be held to account. That's really ultimately the issue. And none of these people are above criticism or being held to account, which is really the role.
Yeah, and, I believe in that too. That's why what I've laid out and some of the things I've said on social media have been critical or just honest, just saying the positions that of Zohran Mamdani that I don't agree with, that people have criticized, and I think with justification in many cases. Doesn't mean I don't like him. I personally like him. I can't say I don't like. I liked him the day I met him, and I've liked him ever since. But I will hold him accountable. Him accountable because this is not about personal loyalty to any individual or to any politician. This is about fundamental, basic principles that we have to defend.
Yeah, and we're not like the New York Times. We're not going to, kiss ass of any politician who gives us some attention or even praise. We're not seeking access, and trying to cement our access to the halls of power. We wouldn't do that.
I would say Zohran Mamdani come on the Electronic Intifada live stream.
I don't know.
we would be happy to talk to you.
If I could advise Zohran Mamdani, what I would say is don't rest on your laurels. Like, don't think that you've because you've won this victory, and it is a very significant victory. Don't underestimate the ability of the pro-Israel lobby in particular to make your life difficult. I mean, I think that is really should be the lesson of Jeremy Corbyn, of the failure of Jeremy Corbyn to become the prime minister. When he won the victory that he did back in 2015 of becoming the leader of the opposition, becoming the leader of the Labour Party, it's easy to forget now what a massive victory that was. It was incredibly significant. And yet, Jeremy Corbyn did similar things to what Zohran is doing now in embracing this police commissioner who acted for the crackdown against the student protests. He's now embracing her and keeping her on. Jeremy Corbyn did very similar things at the beginning of his term as leader of the opposition, and he made his entire shadow cabinet out of the right wing of the Labour Party, because he said he didn't bring his own people on at first. He didn't bring on Diane Abbott and John McDonnell and all those people on the left of the Labour Party. He brought on the right wing of the Labour Party because he was trying to say, he was trying to embrace them and to disprove the scare stories about him. And he was trying to say that, oh, we're a broad church of the Labour Party, and he actually meant it. Well, his enemies weren't acting in good faith.
No, they never
and so did. there's a real danger that Zoran could fall in the same trap. And actually, the police commissioner, Zoran's saying he's going to keep her on. Will she want to stay on? I don't know. I mean, I don't know enough about New York politics to say that she may want to stay on. But there is certainly a possibility that the people he tries to embrace like this will actually quit on him and kind of backstab him, because that's what happened to Corbyn with his. With his right-wing shadow cabinet. They conspired, backed by the pro-Israel lobby, they conspired against him, and they all quit in succession to kind of engineer this crisis against him in 2016, which led to a second leadership campaign against him. So, you know, there's a lot of lessons there to be learned, which I don't think enough people are really taking on board.
It remains to be seen.
We'll be watching.
All the lessons apply, and we will be watching. We'll be watching. Exactly.
I just think it's too simplistic for people to say, oh, you know, none of this matters. It's significant that people voted for someone they understood to be calling what Israel is doing a genocide. So let's not forget, let's not make this, I mean, I say this after I just spent all that time talking about Mamdani. Let's not make this about just Mamdani. This is about the people who voted and the message they sent. Yeah. And I think that, you know, when a vote is a pretty blunt instrument, you know, you can't say you vote for a candidate, you're saying, well, I agree with, you can't split your vote a thousand ways and say, well, I'm voting for this part, not for that. It's a yes or no with a candidate. And I think this was a resounding yes to somebody who was expressing, in very human terms, the horror that so many people feel at this genocide.
Yeah.
And that's not a small thing.
No.
It's and not it's, a small thing.
It's always delicious to watch the Zionist communities crash out over somebody who doesn't capitulate to their pressure, isn't one of those mayors that just, you know, robotically said, my first trip will be to the Holy Land or, you know, to Israel. That's what they expected. That's what they paid for. And when Zoran said, you know, in that clip that you played, well, I'm going to stay here in New York because I want to be the mayor of this city. I think that was the beginning of the great Zionist crash out over him. And it's been honestly pretty fun to see them, you know, tripping over themselves and trying to understand where they went wrong when, as you were saying, Ali, this is a referendum, not just by people in New York City, but by people all over the country who are fed up with the propaganda, who aren't taking the bait anymore. And these organizations like, you know, the AJC and the ADL are simply being marginalized to the point of total, people just don't think about them anymore. They don't have any weight anymore. And I think that is due to people, you know, understanding what Israel has always been about, the U.S.'s role in it. And people don't, you know, you don't just forget about a genocide being live streamed to your phone for 2 years. So we'll see what that means in terms of the political future for this settler colony on this continent. We're our eyes are open and we should remain so.
That was the Electronic Intifada discussing what the Zohran Mamdani win means, and how the debate on the left is progressing right now, where people that have been burned by progressive politicians have failed to meet their promises. And let's hope for the best. We'll see you next week at 2 p.m. On Wednesday. This is Zain Al-Amin signing off from the Shai Onana Show.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnestad. Democrats on the House Oversight Committee have released emails from wealthy late pedophile Jeffrey Epstein written about President Donald Trump in 2011. Epstein wrote, Trump spent hours at his house with a redacted name that Democrats identify as a victim of sex trafficking. Another email years later said Trump knew about the girls. Trump has consistently denied any knowledge of Epstein's soliciting of minors and alleged abuse, and has said he ended their relationship years ago. But in a 2011 email released today to Epstein's then-girlfriend, Ghislaine Maxwell, who's now in prison for sex trafficking minors for Epstein, Epstein wrote to her, quote, I want you to realize that the dog that hasn't barked is Trump, unquote. That year, Epstein was required to register as a sex offender in the state of New York. The emails add to the questions about the president's friendship with Epstein and any knowledge he may have had in what prosecutors call a years-long effort by Epstein to exploit underage girls. This comes as House Speaker Mike Johnson has summoned lawmakers back to the House to vote on a continuing resolution to reopen the federal government, with the House back in session after 8 weeks starting today. Arizona's representative-elect Democrat Adelita Grijalva will get a swearing-in more than a month after winning a special election to replace her late father Raul Grijalva. She's expected to provide the final vote to pass a bipartisan resolution calling on the Department of Justice to release its files on Jeffrey Epstein. With the chance it could be the last day of the longest government shutdown in U.S. history now at day 43, House Democrats are vowing to carry on the fight for health care by introducing an amendment to extend the pandemic-era health care subsidies for the Affordable Care Act marketplace for some 22 million Americans who use it. They're slated to expire by year's end. The bill would extend the subsidies for 3 years. Here's House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York and Jim McGovern of Massachusetts.
Because of the Republican refusal to extend the Affordable Care Act tax credits in the midst of a cost of living crisis that already exists, that they failed to address, health care for people all across this country is on the brink of becoming unaffordable.
We're not going to give up, and we're going to fight like hell until this gets done.
With GOP control of the House, Republicans could just reject it. The Supreme Court has extended its order blocking full SNAP payments with no explanation on the court's thinking and will expire just before midnight Thursday. People who depend on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program to feed families in some states have received full monthly allotments, while others have received nothing. The ruling likely to further delay the food aid from reaching many of the 42 million Americans who rely on it, because in the United States, 1 in 8 people are poor enough to qualify for it. Also, no timeline on when flight cuts will ease up after the government shutdown ends. Airlines have canceled more than 9,000 flights across the country. Tuesday, another 1,200 flights canceled. A Virginia transportation security officer is accusing the Department of Homeland Security of sex discrimination over its policy barring transgender officers from performing security pat-downs. The TSA enacted the policy in February to comply with an executive order by the president declaring two unchangeable sexes. The lawsuit filed Friday argues the policy violates civil rights laws and bars the officer from using restrooms aligning with their gender identity. The USS Gerald Ford aircraft carrier strike group has arrived in the Caribbean, escalating U.S. military presence near Venezuela. The world's largest aircraft carrier joins 8 warships, a submarine, and F-35 fighters already operating in the region as part of President Trump's purported campaign against drug cartels that have bombed boats some 17 times, killing 79 people, including fishermen. Venezuela seeing it as a provocation. I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.